Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Bring in show music, please.
Hi, I'm CNBC producer Katie Kramer. Today on Squawk Pod, Amazon CEO Andy Jassy.
I do think that AI is going to transform every customer experience that we know.
Customer experiences like drone delivery?
When you think about what we're doing with drones, with Prime Air, I think in several years, when they're more pervasive, we'll be able to get items to customers in less than an hour.
Andrew Ross Sorkin sat down at Amazon HQ the morning of Jassy's shareholder letter to talk about innovation and consumers.
People are still, they are still buying, they're just being careful about what they shop for.
But you're seeing a trade down.
We are.
Plus, Amazon's approach to in-office work and Andy Jassy's take on federal regulators cracking down on mergers.
I think that, you know, some of these organizations are making decisions that are outside the bounds of the law.
It's Thursday, April 11th. Squawk Pod begins right now.
Stand Becky by in 3, 2, 1. Cue, please.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Squawk Box right here on CNBC. We are live from the NASDAQ market site in Times Square. I'm Becky Quick along with Mike Santoli. Andrew is reporting live from Seattle. And Andrew, what do you have coming up today? This is pretty big.
Good morning to you, Becky. We do have a big show right here. We are live at Amazon's headquarters in Seattle for a very big interview this morning. Couldn't be better timed. Given all the conversations we're having about the consumer and inflation and so much more, we're going to be speaking this morning with the CEO of Amazon, Andy Jassy, about just about everything. We're going to talk about the state of the consumer, AI, the battle with Microsoft, AWS, advertising, Prime, and so much more. You know, the last time we were here, just about a year ago, things were in a very different place. The stock was challenged. There were some layoffs taking place. There was a whole big restructuring taking place around the distribution model at the company. And if you look at where things are right now, even with some of the downward pressure on stocks across the board, you're looking at a market cap of $1.9 trillion. Company now making about $575 billion in revenue, sitting on about $70 billion in cash. Just about now. The stock is up year to date and is now up about 6% since Andy Jassy took over from Jeff Bezos in July 5th, 2021. Of course, that was in the middle of the pandemic. So we have so much to talk to him about, and we will be bringing that interview to you.
And as you mentioned, given everything with inflation, given how the consumer may be feeling at this point, really a perfect time to be talking to him about what he sees with his huge retail operations, and then beyond that, what's happening with technology. In fact, if you take a look at where the markets stand right now, after some big declines yesterday, the Dow was down by 420-some points. You saw similar declines at the NASDAQ and the S&P 500. You have the Treasury market, where this was pretty phenomenal yesterday. We got that hotter-than-expected CPI number. Yields and the markets, the equity markets, moved instantaneously on this. We saw about a 20 basis point move in the 2 year within a matter of minutes. And Mike, what was phenomenal about this? This was not a major move if you're looking at equities. Pullback of 400 plus points is about 1%. But the shift in mentality, I think, around this, with the big moves that you saw in the Treasury markets, and then the idea that, okay, maybe the Fed's not going to be cutting quite as soon.
It definitely did create a plot twist for the assumptions about how this year was going to go. I mean, I think if you go back a month, the idea was, the bull case for stocks was, of course, the economy's better than expected, earnings are turning higher, bond yields have been tame in a range for months, and oil was okay, even though it was rising. And on top of it all, we were likely to get the Fed to ease pretty soon into a record high stock market,
right,
and a strong economy. And so now it seems there's a little more, first of all, waiting to be done for inflation to get better. And also just, you know, there's trade-offs. So we have to understand if the Fed is going to start to think the economy has to slow a lot more before they can declare victory on inflation. So I do think it's a complicating factor. Only a 1% move down, as you said, in stocks. In fact, yesterday, that was the move that was kind of predicted by the options market. But yields are going to determine if stocks can kind of get out of this fix, because you had some consumer cyclical stocks did suffer. There is some rate sensitivity in this
market. And you're looking at things like commodities prices, whether that be oil, whether that be copper, whether that be aluminum, the precious metals across the board, all of those commodities prices higher. Concerns about what Iran's going to do in retaliation, what that could mean for oil prices, too. But when you have all of the commodities moving at the same time, then that brings you to concerns about what that will eventually mean for inflationary prices.
The goods disinflation seems like we've gotten the benefit of that. You probably can't count on that going in the right direction from here. You know, the actual upside surprise to the CPI yesterday was really modest. It was 0.36% rounding to 0.4 instead of 0.34% rounding down. However, it did create this idea that we just can't count on it going down from here. You're going to have harder comparisons in the next several months. So we have to, see how we all navigate that on a policy basis.
Hey, Andrew, you've got some breaking news from there, too.
There's Amazon CEO Andy Jassy's annual letter to shareholders is out, and he strikes a more optimistic tone than the year prior, which was, of course, a challenging one as the company was navigating both the layoffs and restructurings of its distribution centers after the pandemic. Amazon stock now trading near all-time highs, and it has been quite a turnaround. The investments Amazon making in its delivery networks and artificial intelligence appear to be paying off. AI, of course, a big theme of this year's letter. Jassy writing the following. He says, quote, "We are optimistic that much of the world's changing AI will be built on top of AWS. Part of that strategy is Amazon's effort to compete in the chips business." Meantime, on AWS sales, Jassy's saying that he's seeing big improvements. While in 2022, companies were trying to save money. If you remember at the time, they were allowing customers to effectively downgrade and upgrade their services. Jassy saying at the end of 2023, he saw, quote, cost optimization attenuating, new deals accelerating, and customers renewing at larger commitments over longer time periods. Amazon has changed its delivery network to now a regional model to bring products closer to customers. Jassy saying that the shift has brought down costs per unit costs down by 45 cents in the United States. Also, the number of items delivered same day or overnight increasing. This is a remarkable number. We're going to talk to him about it, by almost 70%. That's an enormous shift. Meantime, on its advertising business, that grew 24% year over year to $47 billion. And then on Amazon Prime, the Prime Video service, Jassy writing, quote, "We have increasing conviction that Prime Video can be a large and profitable business on its own." So a lot of folks in the media universe are likely to take note of that. And I'll be speaking with Amazon CEO about all of this and so much more.
So those 7 billion items delivered same day, Andrew, I was just trying to figure out how many of them are arriving at my house. A lot of them. It's, you know, it is my my new go-to on, well, not my new go-to. Yep. It's my go-to on anything. Especially if you're getting ready to leave on vacation or do anything else. Like, man, I need this. I need it right now. And they have an army of people who will deliver those things to you instantaneously almost.
They do about $575 billion, we should say, in revenue. So I don't know how much you, the Quick family, accounts for that revenue.
More
piece,
than we but, should, let's say. Andrew, it's going to be a fascinating interview. We can't wait to see it.
Cheese will be next.
Amazon CEO Andy Jassy is next. We'll talk consumers, inflation, what's on Amazon Prime, and so much more, including how artificial intelligence is learning from your shopping data.
As you build these really big models, we have not yet gotten to a point where the models are so smart that they wouldn't benefit from more data. And so, you know, I think people are looking for data, but we're being thoughtful about how we use it.
Squawk Pod will be right back.
From their innovative practice facility to unmatched views from the fairway, the PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with 5G solutions from T-Mobile for Business. Together, we're using AI-powered analytics to expand coaching tools and bringing fans closer to the pros with 5G-connected cameras. This is game-changing innovation. This is the PGA of America with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, Our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Welcome back to Squawk Pod from CNBC. And we're going right to Seattle today for Andrew Ross Sorkin's exclusive sit-down with Amazon CEO Andy Jassy.
We are here in Seattle this morning at Amazon's headquarters. And earlier this morning, the company's CEO Andy Jassy released his annual letter to shareholders, touching on everything from product pricing to cost cutting to delivery speeds, artificial intelligence, and so much more. And Andy Jassy joins me now in an exclusive interview, and we're thrilled to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for waking up early to do this. You know, we were just talking about this inflation data, and before we even get into Amazon, I'm just so curious, given that you have your tentacles in so many parts of the economy, from the consumer to the business-to-business side of things, how you see things and how you see things as it relates specifically to inflation right now.
Well, what we see are consumers are spending, but they're just being really careful about what they spend on and how much they spend. And so wherever they can, they're trading down in average selling price. You see consumers, wherever they can find a deal, they take the deal. It's going to take a lot for people not to buy detergent or shampoo or things like that. And you can see that in the growth of our everyday essentials business, which Q4 of 2023 was over 20% year over year. Some of that is because people are going to buy all the time, but some of that is just because of the speed that we have and we're getting to people so they consider us for more. But people are still, they are still buying. They're just being careful about what they shop for.
But you're seeing a trade down.
We are. We see people trading down on ASP wherever they can. I'd say on the enterprise side, the last couple of years, companies have tried to save money however they could. And we saw it a lot in our AWS business and the cost optimization we saw. But I think a lot of that cost optimization has attenuated. And we've seen a lot of the deals that people were talking about with us for a long time, that were sitting on the back burner have started to move. Migrations have picked up again. The pipeline is really full. And I think people have moved from largely trying to save costs to figuring out how to modernize their infrastructure again, move from on-premises to the cloud, and then think about how they can use generative AI to change their business.
Are you seeing, though, on the cost side, on the inflation side, things continue to rise? Are there places where you see price declines? Are you seeing anything in terms of wages, either on your own employees or others?
Again, we see consumers are spending. They're just trading down. A place where we see it, real impact is, in discretionary items, things like TVs or computers or electronics. We're growing our market segment share at a faster rate there than others, but still at a lower rate than what we see in a healthy economy.
I want to start, there's 100 places to go here because you touch on just about everything in this letter, but I want to start with AI because it seems to be the buzzword of everything. When we were here last year, we were talking about AI, but it was unclear, I think, completely where Amazon was going to play in this AI world. And you now say it is going to change everything and that you have really almost shifted the whole company towards AI in almost every space now.
Yeah, we've been saying it for a while, and I do think that AI is going to transform every customer experience that we know. And I think a lot of the discussion has been around applications and starting really with ChatGPT, which really caught people's attention. But we think there are three big macro areas of the generative AI stack, each of which are gigantic and each of which we're investing deeply in. And I think of it as at the lowest layer are for people that are building their own large language models. And the two things that really matter there is the compute to train the model and to run the predictions of the inferences. And what matters in that is the chip. And then the services that you have to actually build models. And we've got very significant investments there. Most of the early AI models have been built by NVIDIA, but supply is more scarce and people are concerned about cost. And so we've built our own custom silicon in AI. We've built a training chip called Trainium and an inference chip called Inferentia that are meaningfully more price performant than what you can find out there. So a lot of the training, a lot of the predictions are going to be done on those chips. And, and then I would say at that middle layer of the stack are for people that are going to actually leverage somebody else's model, but customize it with their own data and then use our features to make it easy as a service. And we built the service called Bedrock. And a lot of the generative AI applications are being built on top of Bedrock because it's the easiest way to build a high-quality generative AI application. Then there's the applications, of which, you know, we're building a lot of them ourselves, but the vast majority of those will be built by third parties, and we're optimistic a lot of them will be built on AWS.
Let me ask you about this. Let's talk about large language models, because there's just so much focus on it. You have now made investments in Anthropic, which Google has also made an investment in. You're building your own large language model called Olympus. How are you thinking about investing in things like an Anthropic versus trying to build your own?
Well, I think the one thing that we've seen pretty consistently in this relatively early stage of generative AI is that customers want choice. You know, they're learning how to build models. They want different model types for different types of applications and use cases. They want different model sizes because it changes the latency and the cost structure. And so, you know, part of the attraction for so many people of Bedrock, I was just mentioning, is just it has the largest selection of models available. It's got not only models that we build, but also Anthropic and Meta with Llama 2 and Mistral and Cohere and Stability AI. So you have a lot of choices. And then Bedrock makes it really simple to move between models and move between model sizes so that you can actually experiment and get the right quality and latency. We're going to, for us, and we see it with our own, we're building dozens of generative AI applications right now, some of which are launched, others are in development. We find it with our own model builders and our own application builders that sometimes they want to use our own app, our own models, sometimes they want to use third-party models, and we're going to give people choice so they can make those decisions.
How important, though, is it for you to catch up on having your own generative AI large language model? Meaning this Olympus project, which has been reported on, how important is that? How far behind do you think you are? What do you have to do to get that to the same level as where Anthropic may very well be or where you believe OpenAI is today?
Well, I mean, first of all, what I would tell you is that this is going to transform virtually every experience we know. It's a gigantic space, and there are going to be a lot of very successful players in it. And if you go talk to enterprises or companies that are using generative AI, they are very excited about what we're building, and more customers are moving to our services. And we're going to have partnerships. We have a very deep partnership with Anthropic. Claude 3, which they released just a few weeks ago, is the best model on the planet right now with the best performance, and it runs best on top of AWS. And so our customers are very excited about that. But at the same time, we have a lot of experience building models at the company. We've been doing it for a long time, and we've been building our own models and these Titan models we have. We're going to keep building those, and we're going to give people choice.
Big issue with building these models is the data input that's being used to train. Do you know, for example, with your new large language model, what data you're using to train it on? There were reports that OpenAI was desperate for data. They actually built a program just so they could create transcripts of YouTube videos so they could train off the transcripts because they didn't think they had enough data. And that, of course, raised questions about copyright and the like. But I'm so curious how you guys are doing it.
Well, we have a group of people that spend a fair bit of time, all the time, by the way, because the landscape continues to evolve, but thinking through the best way to build the models. We're very thoughtful and very careful about what data we use. We, of course, have some proprietary data and some licensed data and some publicly available data, and we use all of it, sources.
Some people ask, because someone asked me this, you have all the books in the world, many on Kindle. Are you able to train on that data?
Again, there's some of that data we can train on. We try to be thoughtful about what data we train on. We also do licensing deals in some of these cases in different types of data. And so, these models, they're getting smarter and smarter. And I think you've probably read about, as you build these really big models, we have not yet gotten to a point where the models are so smart that they wouldn't benefit from more data. And so, I think people are looking for data, but we're being thoughtful about how we use it.
Does it matter that something like an Anthropic also is operating with Google? I mean, they have an investment in them as well. They're on their cloud as well. I ask because I looked, you have $70+ billion in cash. Would you just prefer to buy the whole company if you could?
We have a great partnership with Anthropic, and it's true with most technology. If you operate in the technology space, you get pretty comfortable with co-opetition. It's just the way it works, and so we have a great relationship with them, and we're very comfortable with the arrangement. We're excited about the investment. Remember, as part of our relationship, it's not just that we offer their models in an easy to way use on Bedrock. They're training their future models on our chips, right, on Trainium, and they also named us as their primary cloud partner. And so there's a lot of collaboration there. We're really happy about the relationship.
Do you think you could buy a firm like Anthropic in this environment from a regulatory perspective?
I don't know. I mean, I think we got to be careful right now in Western countries in the way that we're handling regulation. I think a really good example of that is what happened with iRobot, if you follow that. You
know? Yep.
So I think it's a really kind of a sad story. It's a great entrepreneurship story where you had this, this American company that invented this product, invented the category, and built a business that was almost $1 billion in revenue. And whenever you build a good business, you end up with company and competition. So they attract these two very large Chinese companies as competitors. And they needed scale, because scale lets you buy components at the right price and invest in R&D. So they merge with Amazon, and the European Commission blocks it because they worry that we're going to feature our vacuum cleaner, their Roomba versus others, which of course is not our model, because we make actually at least as much money selling third-party items as our own. But they block it, and then immediately after they block it, the FTC comes out and says, oh, we would have blocked it if they hadn't. And so what happens? We abdicate the acquisition. iRobot lays off a third of its staff. The stock price completely tanks. And now is a real question whether they're going to be a going concern. Turns out with these in-house vacuum cleaners, they have to map the inside of your house. That's the way way they don't run into a table or a chair. So really what Western regulators were saying was that they trust these two large Chinese companies with maps of the inside of U.S. consumers' homes more than they do Amazon, even though we've been an amazing steward of customer data in our retail business and for AWS, where customers of both those businesses will tell you that. That can't be what we were going for. And so I think people don't know what they can do right now, and I just think we got to try and find a way to be reasonable in what we're doing.
The FTC is looking into even the partnership that you have with Anthropic. They're looking at the way Microsoft's relationship exists with OpenAI. I'm sure they're going to look at Microsoft's sort of acqui-hire deal. I don't know what you think of that as it relates to inflection. I mean, it's very interesting what's happening. Nobody's making outright acquisitions, but in some ways these partnerships are in lieu of that. No?
Yeah, I mean, there are some acquisitions happening, but we're consuming a lot of time and taxpayers' money with what we're doing right now, and I think a lot of it is outside the bounds of the law right now.
Outside the bounds of the law in terms of how far you think the regulators are going?
I think some of these organizations are making decisions that are outside the bounds of the law.
Let me ask you this. Since we're on the topic of regulation, I want to get into what you've done with sellers over the past year and just what's happening on the consumer side of the platform, which is a remarkable thing given how you changed the distribution model and the like. And you now have more sellers on the platform than ever. But at the same time, you have the FTC out there saying that you are a monopoly, that one out of every $2 that a seller on the platform is getting is going back to you in the context of advertising, servicing the distribution, and the like. What do you make of that?
Well, I think you got to start with facts, and if you look at on Amazon, over 60% of the units we sell are sold by third-party sellers. It's not hard to actually create software to put up an e-commerce website or storefront. It's much harder to get distribution and access to customers, which is what Amazon gives sellers. Our sellers on average sell about $230,000 in our marketplace. We have thousands of sellers who sell over $1 million a year in our marketplace. So sellers are making a lot more money selling on Amazon than they could on their own. Then if you look at things like Fulfillment by Amazon, which is our service that allows you to store your products with Amazon and we'll pick, pack, and ship it for you, and it also is available for Prime shipping, that saves sellers over 70% from having to do it themselves. So it costs money, so we charge a fee for it, but it's much more cost-effective for sellers. And while there's always things that we can be doing better for sellers, and we work really hard at it, we have a great relationship with sellers.
Is it a better business, you think, to have a third-party marketplace or to have a first-party marketplace? If you look at just the margin and the fees that you've been able to accumulate from third parties, is that a better business? Is it less capital intensive? Is it more capital intensive?
It's a very good question. They're both really interesting businesses. On the one of the main reasons that we have a first-party business is that it allows us to make sure for the items that customers care a lot about that otherwise wouldn't happen, that you can keep the prices as low as possible for customers and keep the in-stock levels the way you want. But wherever we have third-party sellers who are selling, it's always a great value proposition, and you know, they sell the majority of units for us now.
One of the things that you write about in this letter is this idea of primitives. And I just wanted to talk about it for a second so that the those who follow Amazon understand it. It's really a way you think about building new parts of the business. Can you give me a sort of a 60-second overview for those who don't haven't had a chance to read this letter yet, what that even means?
Yeah, so think of a primitive as a foundational building block that does one thing really well, and that people can stitch together however they see fit. And when we came up with this idea of primitives about 20 years ago, most of the software and technology services out there were these all singing, all dancing services that did lots of things, but none of them very well.
Right.
And what we ran into, and we were building that way too. We had a number of these e-commerce services like payments or ordering or item catalog or search, that when we started doing deals with companies like Target, where Target.com used Amazon's e-commerce technology under the covers to try and provide the individual services through API so they could customize however they saw fit, was way harder than we imagined because all of our services had depended on each other and become jumbled up. And so around this same time, when we were building AWS, we were really convicted that we're gonna build this set of foundational building block primitive services like storage or compute or database that people could stitch together however they saw fit. And the two big advantages are it really fosters creativity because you know, you can combine the components however you want, and it fosters speed because if you want to actually use one component, you don't have to ask five services to make a change. You just use that component.
And now you're using that across the board for just about everything that you build.
Yeah.
Including on the consumer side, one of the things I said at the top of this was you really redid the entire distribution model of how you get products to consumers, and you've been able to get them more quickly than ever before. We were shocked, up 70% in terms of 70%.
Same day, one day.
What is that going to look like in 2 or 3 years from now? And can you continue to bring the cost down? Because that's one of the pieces of this.
I think yes. I think we've been, last year, we're the fastest shipping speeds for Prime customers in the history of the company. We've been even faster in the first quarter of this year. We have a lot of ideas on how we can continue to take delivery times down. I mean, I talked about, we have these same-day facilities where we have, you know, we store about our top 100,000 SKUs there, but we also have nearby fulfillment centers that can inject selection in there. And they're in our major metro cities, and we can, those fulfillment centers are so streamlined that we can get from the time you pick an order to when we're ready to ship in as low as 11 minutes. We're doubling the number of those. And then when you think about what we're doing with drones, with Prime Air, I think in several years when they're more pervasive, we'll be able to get items to customers in less than an hour.
Okay, I gotta ask you about returns, because this is also a big issue, and there's a whole lot of folks that are very frustrated about what they call fraudulent returns. I didn't even realize that this was a thing. So people are buying stuff on Amazon, oftentimes from third parties, and then they return it, but they don't return the actual product. So it would be, you know, I'd buy these sneakers, and then I'd return a fake version of the sneakers back, and they're grappling with that. Is that something, how do you deal with that?
Well, you know, at our scale, you find you get some of everything. You know, and we've seen that in the past, but we have a pretty substantial team that works on making sure that returns are appropriate, that we keep counterfeit really low. And so you change a little bit of some of your policies on returns on when you actually refund people. And, you know, you try to make sure you know you got the right product before you actually authorize the refund.
What about stolen goods? Because that's another big issue that a lot of brick and mortar retailers worry about. You hear the complaints all the time. They say people are robbing us, and then they're taking that product and they're selling it as a third-party merchant on an Amazon, on an eBay, on these other kinds of services.
Yeah. It doesn't happen. I mean, again, at our scale, you find some of everything, but we have a really significant team that looks for that. And to get author, it's not, you know, you have to get authorization as a seller. We have a group of people looking for items. Right. Whenever we get reports, we act on it. So we have a group of people that are watching that very right. carefully.
One of the stats this year that's just mind-bending is just how big an advertising business you have. Mm. I mean, it's really grown quite remarkably, growing 24% year over year, $38 billion in 2022, now $47 billion in 2023. How should we think about Amazon in that regard? And what is it, where does this go?
Well, you know, look, advertising doesn't work unless you provide the right experience for customers and they respond to it, and then it actually benefits the brands who are advertising. So we, you know, most of our advertising team are actually machine learning practitioners who are actually figuring out the right products to put in front of people. So it doesn't even feel like advertising to them. It actually feels like the item that they were searching for. And you know, we have a product called Sponsored Products that has been very successful in this realm that we've expanded with Sponsored TV. And, you know, it's you know, the Sponsored TV offering right. allows people to have, you know, self-service access to entities like Freevee and Twitch and things like that. But we've recently added the ability for people to do advertising on Prime Video shows and movies. And that's very early stage. But, you know, I expect that we will continue to very thoughtfully find ways to place advertisements right. in the different entities we have.
When you think, though, about Prime Video, one of the sentences that stood out to me in this letter was that you now think that Prime Video could be effectively a profitable and completely standalone business. What does that mean?
Well, I think that when we started with Prime Video, it was very much about driving people to find value in our overall Prime offering. And we found that actually a lot of people would sign up for Prime because of our exclusive content. And then once they become Prime members, they would shop in our e-commerce offering. And so it really drove our business downstream. And that continues to very much be the case. But we now have conviction that apart from the value it drives for the rest of the business, it will be a good economic business on its own as well.
The NBA, does it have a place on Amazon?
I assume you're talking about their upcoming.
Yes.
Well, we'll see. I mean, it's hard not to be impressed with what Adam Silver and the NBA has done. It's just an incredible product, and it's an international product, and we have a lot of respect for them, and we'll see what happens.
I mean, how important are sports, though, for this? And could you ever see yourself spinning this business off? Is it separately, or is it so intertwined
John
to the rest
Ford
of the business?
Ask you to ask me that?
No. I'm genuinely curious.
I don't foresee us spinning it off because it's so tightly integrated right. into our Prime offering. But I do think that sports, I mean, if you look at the ratings of shows every year, sports occupies 90%+ of the top right. ratings. And so we've seen with Thursday Night Football just how many customers love that offering mm-hmm. and how many people come to it and how many Prime subscriptions it drives. And so, you know, Thursday Night Football has been a huge success for us. We've got NASCAR coming. We're gonna have six races right in the middle of the year. We have soccer through UEFA and Champions League. I don't know if you watched the women's Final Four this
yes.
past weekend, which was just unbelievable. You know, we're the exclusive streaming partner on the WNBA, so we'll get to see Caitlin Clark on Prime Video as well. And so sports are very attractive for our customers, right. and you can expect us to do more.
Would you do more deals? We keep talking about Paramount, by the way, all morning, because there's lots of news going on there. You bought, obviously, MGM. Would you want to buy a Paramount if you could?
I think we're pretty comfortable with the offering we have right now, and we're continuing to produce, you know, I think really great exclusive content. I don't know if you've seen Fallout yet or not,
yep.
but it's gotten great reviews, and so I'm really pleased with the content we have, and we're just starting.
Kuiper, let's just talk satellites real quick, because I'm trying to hit everything we can.
I like that you said, let's just talk satellites real quick.
It's very hard to talk satellites real yeah. quick. When do you think we're actually going to see this product? And this would compete, of course, with Starlink.
Well, you know, Kuiper is our low Earth orbit satellite business that we're building. There's 400 to 500 million households across the world that don't have broadband connectivity. They can't right. do the basic things we take for granted. And in October, we got two end-to-end prototypes up where we were able to exercise all the functionality, which is really rare in a prototype test like that. And so We're putting the satellite up. The first big production pieces will be the second half of 24, and we expect to have the service up in the next year or so.
And then finally, real quick, I talked last week to Steve Cohen, the investor, and we were talking about it. He has a very interesting thesis. He thinks we are completely moving to a four-day work week that will be, like, truly established and will change economies as a result of it. I know we were all struggling to get people back to the office to begin with. What are you seeing right now, and do you actually think there is a complete change in how it therefore affects the economy?
I think, you know, my own view is that I think we're on a journey, and we still don't know yet where we're going to end up. And, you know, I do, what I've noticed since we've gotten people back in the office at least three times a week is that the collaboration is much better. If you do a lot of innovation, which we do, just, you know, the way you innovate, it's not like you schedule an hour and you innovate and you invent something and you're done. It's messy, it's meandering, it's wandering. It often takes 90 minutes. When you're done, you don't quite get there, and two people get on a whiteboard and work it out, you know, after the meeting. And so I noticed the collaboration is better, the innovation is better, people understand the culture better, they're more connected to one another. And I just noticed that we've kind of gotten back to our culture more since we've been back in the office.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. Andy Jassy, it has been quite a remarkable year. The stock up 22%. It's near an all-time high, and we appreciate seeing you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for touching so many different topics this morning. Becky, I'm going to send it back to you.
Andrew, I think the thing that jumped out the most to me is his pretty strong take on regulation and how overreach and regulation is really changing things. It's something we hear from a lot of businesses, but Andy Jassy speaking out very forcefully on that. Andrew, great job. We will see you back here tomorrow.
Welcome to the Canva guided meditation for stress at work. Impending deadline? Generate Canva presentations in seconds.
So fast.
Brainstorm got too big? Summarize with AI in a click. Click, click, click. Writer's block. Release with Canva Magic Write.
Magical.
Stress less and save time at canva.com. Designed for work.
Canva.
That's Squawk Pod for today. Thanks for listening. Squawk Box is hosted by Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Tune in weekday mornings on CNBC at 6 Eastern and get the best of our TV show right here on this podcast. And speaking of this podcast, Squawk Pod is a Webby nominee. You have until April 18th to vote for us to be a People's Voice winner. How do you do it? Well, wherever you're listening to us now, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, etc., open the app, scroll through the description and notes of today's pod, and we have the link right there. That takes you directly to the page to vote for our special podcast series featuring the last interview with Berkshire Hathaway Vice Chairman Charlie Munger. Vote for us there. Check out the other Webby nominees, too. We're in some amazing company. And thank you for showing your support. That's it. We'll meet you right back here tomorrow.
We are clear. Thanks, guys.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.